The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, amigos. You know what's really easy to do and even easier to forget? Please help me out and hit that like button if you're listening on YouTube. And if you're listening somewhere else, what the hell? Pop in, give me a thumb. Say hello while you're at it. It helps me a ton with the algorithm. And besides, it's real nice to see you there. And now, on to the show. Hey there, friend. Welcome back to Casa de Blood. It's May 30th, and you know what that means, don't you, Chester? No, not that it's National Mint Julep Day. Who gives a shit about that? It means Ambrose Ibsen's latest collection, From the Heart, was just released on Amazon and Audible. So come on in, friend. Let's go celebrate. It's been a long month waiting for it. Alright. So, check out SimplyScaryPodcast.com this notable holiday and become a patron. For as little as $7.99 a month, you can get the entire catalog ad-free and available to download or stream. There's a little patron button on the top there. You can't miss it. So tonight, we welcome author Ambrose Ibsen by way of our friends at Velox Books. In this one, we join three climbers looking to conquer Mara Peak in Nepal. Not all who have made the journey have managed to reach the summit, and no one likes getting stepped on the way to the top. So without further delay, from author Ambrose Ibsen, I give you The Incident at Mara Peak. I admit, we were warned about setting off in the off-season. The Himalayas are fickle on the best of days. You've got clear skies one moment and a howling blizzard the next. Everyone told us so. Careful planning, especially for the more inexperienced set, was sold to us as a must. Well, they were right. The friends and colleagues who sought to dissuade us, the posters on mountaineering forums who advised us to wait just a few more months, they were right, and the three of us wound up rushing headlong into a profoundly dangerous expedition. We were just experienced enough as climbers to consider these warnings, and just young and arrogant enough to shrug them off when the facts didn't suit us. We should have waited. Honestly, though, if I could go back and do it all over again, I never would have gone. I know David feels the same way. Tom, I imagine, has his share of regrets, too. The reason we charged on, despite all the advice to the contrary, is a silly one in retrospect. You see, it was only during the off-season that the three of us could get weeks off of work to take a trip to the Himalayas at all. We had to skimp and save. We had to build up vacation time and then reason with our stiff-necked bosses to catch a break. I managed a 3-week vacation, and the other two guys secured just over 2 weeks of leave, some of it unpaid. We flew out to Nepal on a shoestring at the first opportunity, but I wish we had never gone. It isn't just the cold, the weeks of suffering we endured. Sure, we had a rough go of it. Most of my right pinky finger is still chilling somewhere on the slopes of Mara Peak, having sloughed off after a bout of frostbite. We took our lumps, but if that had been all, it wouldn't have been so bad. We'd have come home banged up, but with a good story to tell. Ironically, for someone who set off in the hopes of having a good story to share, I don't like talking about the incident at Mara Peak. We were abroad 4 weeks all told, 5 actually if you include the time we spent in the hospital, and I wish I could forget every second. What really makes me wish we hadn't gone, the thing that really keeps me up at night, isn't the pain, the ice, the life or death struggle we faced while trying to climb that peak. It's the thing we encountered in the snowstorm, the thing that followed us. In brief, Mara Peak is a great trekking destination. Its highest highs will bring you up more than 20,000 feet and offer a view of some of the world's largest mountains. You don't need a lot of fancy gear to climb it. Some trekking poles, good boots, and warm clothes will do. Compared to a lot of other more famous and difficult climbing destinations, Mara Peak is a walk in the park. If you are reasonably fit and take care to acclimatize, you should have no real problems completing the expedition. Beginners often take between 18 and 24 days to do it, but having years of experience between the three of us, we were determined to do it at the breakneck speed of 10 days. We slept off the jet lag in a cheap hotel and hopped on a bus which brought us to the base of the Himalayas. We had packed fairly light, not wishing to be weighed down by unnecessary supplies. Food and means of water purification had been brought in abundance, but we had trimmed all the fat, leaving behind the ropes and other goodies you can't do without on a more difficult climb. None of us had ever been to the Himalayas before. David, a friend of mine since high school, had been climbing all his life, having grown up in the Pacific Northwest. He was the one that first exposed me to the hobby, and we'd spent our college summers traveling, conquering little climbs around the U.S. This trip to Mara Peak felt like something special. Our first real climb, far from our home turf. Tom was a bit of a wild card, though. He was a newish member of a local climbing club, and as such, we didn't know him particularly well. He was a big guy, very tall, with a background in football and weightlifting. David thought he was hilarious, and when we first began planning our trip to Mara Peak, he suggested we bring Tom along. Usually, I would have vetoed the idea outright. I found the guy a bit obnoxious, and besides, making a more serious climb with someone I didn't know felt like a liability. I only acquiesced because the presence of a third body helped us secure certain discounts on travel and accommodation.
Tom can handle it, don't worry. Complete novices flock to Mara Peak from all around the world, man,
David had assured me. Though less experienced than David and I, Tom was arguably fitter than either of us, and he had performed reasonably well on smaller trips with the club back in the States.
Trust me, he'll be a good fit for this.
After running the numbers and talking through it with David, I relented. We shot Tom a text inviting him, and he signed on eagerly. When the fateful day arrived, we piled into David's beater and drove to the airport. Less than 72 hours later, we were putting on our gear and preparing for the trek. The weather really couldn't have been any better, at least at the start. We were taken in by the clear skies, the great visibility and easygoing terrain during the first several hours, And in our enthusiasm and naivety, we never suspected the Himalayan range's capriciousness. A bright sun joined us as we set out from the base, a charming companion that robbed the wind of its icy bite.
"This is too easy,"
remarked Tom as we charged up the mountain that first afternoon.
"Mount Rainier's got tougher climbs than this."
"Sure, it's easy now," replied David. "But don't get too comfortable. I hear there are some rough spots along the way. Better to pace yourself."
"Pace myself?"
balked Tom.
"I feel like I could climb to the top right now. No breaks. Let's marathon the thing. What do you say, Eli?"
"Be my guest,"
I laughed.
"Just don't come crying to me when it starts to snow and you end up in a whiteout."
Our first day's progress was brisk, and we blazed a steady trail for several hours before we stopped for our first breather. I kept the occasional eye on the compass and altimeter, while Tom cracked jokes and David brought up the rear. Walking furiously through the untrodden snow, we encountered no one from sunup to sundown. That first day was textbook, and we set up our tents by a little outcropping that served to keep off the wind. We ate and reveled and eventually turned in, spirits very high. The second day was no different. We made swift progress, tearing up the peak at a speed that surprised us, and found another excellent spot to camp in. Our meals, though simple, were filling, and we seemed to be adjusting well to the altitude. It was the morning of the third day when things began to change. We awoke to a hazy sunrise, hazy because powdery snowfall was raining down upon us and cutting our visibility down to a fraction of what we had enjoyed the previous days. The three of us thought little of this. We packed our things, scarfed down a quick meal, and put our trust in the instruments. The altimeter and compass would give us a good idea of our progress and whereabouts, even in poor visibility. I remember we trekked on through the flurry, Tom mouthing off all the while. But what had begun as a mere nuisance, a light flurry slowly grew into a heavy and potentially dangerous snowfall.
"It's really coming down,"
uttered David, strapping on a pair of goggles.
"What's your over-under on this stuff petering out?"
50-50,
I said.
"It could blow over." "I let it snow. This is what we came for, isn't it? The real Himalayan experience,"
said Tom. And snow it did. The winds picked up. The once pleasant temperatures dipped to polar lows, and we were gradually humbled by the more difficult conditions. After 4 or 5 hours of braving the building storm, we decided to take a short break and shelter behind a cluster of rocks. There, we watched the stuff come down in giant flakes while resting.
"All right, maybe I've had enough of the snow,"
admitted Tom, tugging his hat over his cherry red earlobes.
"Can't see a thing in this. It'll clear up soon, won't it?"
"It might not clear up,"
replied David. He squinted through the storm and tried to study the sky. The heavens were a uniform gray and snow was falling as far as the eye could see.
"In fact, it could get worse."
"Go ahead and jinx us, why don't you?"
blurted Tom.
"That's just what we need. What's the altitude now, Eli?"
he asked me.
"We still on target?"
"Barely,"
I replied.
"We're really gonna have to book it if we want to hit our goal for the day."
And this was easier said than done, of course. The path was already covered in old, partially frozen snow, some of which was difficult to walk through. Fresh snowfall was only going to make our progress more difficult. It was perhaps an hour, maybe two, after that short break when Tom called out to us from the center of the pack.
"Hey, what is this?"
he shouted.
"Guys, what in the world?"
He was crouched in the snow, staring at something on the ground. I doubled back to the spot and David hastened to meet us. It didn't take long for the three of us to realize what Tom had literally stumbled upon. While marching a few yards behind me, He happened to list a bit to the left and to stamp upon something buried in the recent snowfall. It was a little mound of sticks and smooth round stones. Until Tom's boot had gone crashing through them, they had likely been stacked neatly in a vaguely conical shape.
It looks like you accidentally stepped on a memorial or grave marker, I said.
It's a what?
Blurted Tom.
A grave? You mean someone's buried here?
Could be,
offered David. He pulled his scarf up over his mouth and nose and took a few deep breaths that left his goggles foggy.
This is the Himalayas, man. The real thing. People die up here all the time. Guides, climbers. People get into trouble and can't get the help they need. And when they die, it's not always feasible to transport a body down a mountain, you know?
Tom stared down at the ruined memorial with a mixture of horror and disgust.
You're kidding, right? No way there's really a body here.
You didn't mean to stop on it, I said, preparing to continue on.
There's too much snow. You couldn't see. Any one of us could have run into it. It's probably a simple grave for a climber who died on the mountain. And it's probably not the only one up here. Come on, let's keep moving.
Tom, though, remained anchored to the spot.
But I thought you guys said that novices came here all the time. That Merritt Peak is an easy climb.
It is, said David. This is a great one for beginners. Just keep your head on straight and pay attention. Else you might end up like this poor guy.
Rather unexpectedly, Tom sneered and gave the memorial another kick with his boot. This one intentional.
Oh, I get it. Someone took a trip up here and just couldn't hang, huh? Well, sucks to be him, I guess. We're getting to the top. Imagine coming out on a climb like this and croaking. What a loser, man. This isn't Everest.
David and I were both bothered by Tom's outburst, and I remember we shared a glance through the storm. Eager to press on, however, we departed from the graveside in silence, resuming our earlier positions. Looking back, that was the moment everything went south. That was the moment that everything began falling apart for us.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
The weather, we soon realized, wasn't going to cooperate. We were looking at a proper snowstorm, and for all we knew, it was going to last forever. Buffeted by terrible winds, blasted by wave after wave of snow and ice, we couldn't help but slow down, which significantly impacted our day's progress. As if that wasn't bad enough, Tom's pace began to lag shortly after our pause, and within an hour or two of departing the little grave, his tortured moans became too loud to ignore. I doubled back to meet the other two and found Tom squatting in the snow, both hands locked around his left ankle.
What's wrong?
I asked.
You need to relace your boots or something?
He shook his head furiously, teeth gritted. It was David who filled me in, yanking down his scarf with a frown.
He's injured! Thinks he strained his ankle when he stepped on that grave marker before. I think I rolled it bad,
added Tom.
I didn't realize it right away, but I think it's when I stepped on those rocks. That idiot back there's dead, and he's still hogging up the trail. I ought to go back and dig him up, spit in his face.
We made the difficult decision to set up camp and rest till the next morning. This would give Tom's ankle some time to heal, and we hoped that the snow would quit in the interim as well. We set up our tents, but had to make do with a less than stellar spot that was ravaged by the winds. David and I both had a look at Tom's ankle, and I'll tell you, it was a pretty terrible sight. The joint was bluish purple and quite swollen. It was a small miracle he had been able to walk on it at all, and we knew at once that our plans were going to have to change. He assured us time and again that he'd be fine after a good night's sleep, that he wouldn't slow us down. But David and I both knew that our dreams of a rapid ascent were all but dashed. After a meal, the three of us settled in for the night. I remember the way the wind howled across our camp and the bone-rattling cold that seeped in through the seams of my tent. The storm wasn't letting up. Quite the opposite. It was worsening. I'd never seen such hard and consistent snowfall as I saw that night, and I haven't seen it since. I tried my best to ignore the wind and was hopeful that we'd enjoy a more peaceful morning. I awoke to a pocket of calm in the dark Himalayan night, with sore and pulsing limbs. The wind had been reduced to the occasional gasp across the nighted mountainside. Here, finally, some hope of improving conditions. Slithering halfway out of my sleeping bag, I went groping through my things for my watch and found that we were still in the wee small hours. By the low greenish glow of the watch, I thrust a hand into the sleeping bag for my bottle of water. I didn't get a chance to take a swig, however. As I sat up with a groan and blinked in the almost perfect darkness, I realized I wasn't alone. Someone was sitting across from me at the entrance to the tent with wide eyes. I yelped, spilling water all over the place, and was about to claw my way through the canvas when I found I recognized my staring visitor.
Tom? Tom, is that you? Dude, what the...
He threw out a cold hand to silence me, head shaking so hard I thought it might rocket off his shoulders.
Don't move. Don't say a word.
He warned me through chattering teeth. He then turned slowly around, squinting at the tent entrance. In search of something to do, his quivering hands found their way to the bottom of my sleeping bag, and he began wringing it nervously between his fists.
Tom,
I whispered, wiping at my face and leaning forward.
What are you doing in here? What's the matter?
He didn't answer at once. His attention was elsewhere. I noticed during lulls in the breeze, he would stiffen from head to toe as though listening with all his might. After a few spells of this, he finally bullied his lips into speech.
There's someone in my tent, Eli.
What?
I sat up and immediately went rummaging for my headlamp.
What do you mean? Is it David?
Tom only shook his head. I got the headlamp going and could see now that Tom had fled his tent in nothing but his long johns and sweatshirt. The soles of his feet were bare and red. He hadn't even bothered to put on a hat or gloves before stealing into my tent. Frightened though I had been to find him staring at me in the dark, I quickly composed myself.
If someone's in your tent, Tom, it must be David. Maybe he was checking on you, man. Wanted to see how your ankle's doing.
Again, he shook his head.
Who else could it be if not David?
I balked.
We're all alone up here. There isn't anyone for miles and miles around. No one would dare weather like this just to climb a mountain and mess with us. You must have had a bad dream or something.
Tom licked his peeling lips.
It isn't David in there, he whispered. I woke up a little while ago. That's when I noticed that there was someone sitting next to my sleeping bag, looking straight down at me, watching me sleep. I thought it was one of you guys at first, but...
He shut his eyes and buried his head in his hands.
There's something in there, Eli, and it was watching me,
came the muffled confession. Thoroughly irritated now, I went digging through my pack for a flashlight, and I thrust it at him.
Oh yeah? Well, let's have a look then.
I nudged him aside and stepped into my boots and jacket before unfastening the tent door and crawling out into the newly fallen snow. As expected, the storm had more or less stopped, leaving us with several more inches of white stuff than before. Not one step out of my tent, I knew that the next day's hike was going to be miserable. I left Tom behind, my breath flashing out before me in puffs of blinding white, and stepped through the calf-deep snow toward his tent. Tom's tent had been left sitting open, and the breeze toyed with the flaps. Focusing the beam of my headlamp, I took hold of one of my trekking poles and made straight for it. On the off chance that Tom wasn't mistaken, that there really was someone waiting for me within, I explored the inside of the tent with a few hard jabs of the pole before hastily crawling in. I trampled his sleeping bag and pack as I made my way through the flaps and wasted no time in doing a complete 360 with my light. As expected, there was no one inside. I did my best to choke back my anger as I exited. Studying the grounds, I couldn't find any disturbances in the fresh snow, save for the prints Tom and I had both left behind.
There's no one in there,
I growled, marching back to my tent.
And the only tracks out there are ours.
Tom met this news skeptically. He peered out from my tent with a narrow gaze, and for several moments seemed unwilling to leave.
I'm not making it up,
he eventually said, gaining his feet with a wince.
There really was.
It was a bad dream or something. Get some shut-eye, will you? Tomorrow's going to be rough. We'll need the rest. He sulked back to his tent. I listened from my own as he refastened the closures and got back into his sleeping bag. Whether he slept any more that night, I can't be sure. I myself only managed a brief and fitful sleep after that, and when the sun reared its head, I greeted it as my enemy. David and I both watched as Tom came shambling out of his tent. He was disheveled, his gear hastily thrown on, and his expression unsteady. He was doing everything in his power to telegraph calm and wellness, but we saw right through him.
How's the ankle?
Asked David, sizing him up as we packed our tents away.
Did the swelling go down overnight?
Tom zipped his coat tightly and kept his head low while feeding us an unconvincing,
it's better.
His awkward limping around the campsite in the deeper snow was a terrible sight, but he refused our offers to help tear down his tent. Maintaining a facade of toughness, he stuffed his things away, and then tried to appear excited for the day's ascent.
So the storm finally blew over. Well, that's good.
Yeah, but it's left a lot of fresh snow behind. The climb's going to be more difficult. I eyed him with pity.
You think you're really okay to go on, Tom?
He ignored me, breaking from the camp with a snort. It was apparently his intention to take the lead position, and he swiped the altimeter and compass from my grasp as he hobbled past.
Let's get to it, fellas. Time's a-wasting.
Tom was fooling no one, of course. For 30-odd minutes, David and I maintained the rear and watched as our injured member tried to cope with only one good leg. The injured ankle sent shockwaves of pain through him with every step, so that he could only progress by lightly stepping on his heel with toes raised. This made for excruciatingly slow travel. For all his posturing, we knew that Tom was down for the count. It would be a matter of days before he was in any position for serious hiking, and by that time our trip would be nearing its end. David and I flanked him and called a stop after Tom had led us a meager distance.
You're finished, Tom. You can't keep walking on that ankle, not unless you want to risk more serious damage,
began David. Tom would hear none of it. He puffed out his barrel chest and gave a hearty laugh, but the unsteady pace he took right after made him suck wind.
It's not that bad, he insisted. Really, if I give it a little stretch now, then it almost feels normal.
Cut it out, I warned. David's right. You could really mess yourself up if you keep pressing on like that. Let's stop here and think this through.
What's there to think about?
Asked Tom, daring another clumsy step. He grit his teeth and tried to recenter his pack.
We're not going to let a sprained ankle run this whole trip. No way.
But Tom, you can't just...
Look here.
Tom kicked a divot in the snow with his good foot and then unfastened his pack.
I can still walk, all right. I'm good for it, guys. This isn't my first rodeo. I know how to deal with an injury like this. Just, if you want to help, maybe carry some of the stuff in my pack. It'll lighten my load and make it easier on me.
He hefted the pack off his shoulders and dropped it in the snow between us.
It feels so much heavier today. Without this thing on my back, I think I'll be able to go faster.
David and I were desperate to salvage our trip.
It's worth a shot, I ventured. But if you still have serious pain, even without a load on your back, we've got to stop.
I reached down and opened the pack, rifling for the heaviest items. David removed his own, and we prepared to divvy up Tom's things between us. As Tom's pack fell open and its contents were bared to the daylight, however, all three of us froze. The water bottles, packs of food, tent, and other essentials we found inside were all expected, but the presence of several large bones, browned and made porous by the elements, took us all by surprise.
What is all this?
Demanded Tom, nudging the pack over with his toe. The stuff within came tumbling out. A thermos, a rib, a small first aid kit, a collarbone and several finger bones, extra tent stakes and a femur. His face went whiter than the snow, and he looked to both of us with wide, watery eyes.
What is all this?
He demanded, as though we should know. We had no answer for him. Neither of us had tampered with his things. Tom bent down and picked up the pack, emptying its contents completely with a look of disgust. Bones and essentials went tumbling into the snow as we stood and watched in horror.
What is all this?
He kept asking, chapped lips trembling. David took a step back and fixed Tom with a queasy smile.
Is this some kind of joke, dude? Did you pack this stuff ahead of time to freak us out?
The resulting look in Tom's eyes was deathly serious.
Really?
He motioned to the mess of human remains on the ground between us.
You think this is some kind of prank? You think I did this?
Let's calm down for a minute, I warned them. There's no reason to fight, to freak out, okay? I took a deep breath and carefully picked up Tom's empty pack, smoothing it out with my gloved hands. No one's been messing with your pack, Tom. It was in your tent all night, remember? Tom pulled the pack out of my grasp and began stuffing his thing, sans bones, back into it.
I didn't do this,
he kept muttering.
And maybe it wasn't you guys.
He glanced at me in his periphery, his tall frame reeked by a tremor.
Last night, I saw someone in my tent, remember?
Wait, you saw what?
Tom had a bad dream or something, I put in hastily. He thought he saw someone sitting in his tent with him late last night. He woke me up, but I told him it was impossible. We're alone up here. It's the off-season, and we're far from the base now. The odds of running into someone up here are minuscule.
But apparently the odds aren't zero,
snapped Tom. He stared down at the dome of a human skull protruding from the snow. One of its cavernous sockets was trained skyward, and he shuddered terribly at meeting its vacant gaze. Turning with a wince, he began stumbling on.
Forget it. Forget all this. Let's move.
Tom, hold up, I warned. Let's take it easy for a second. There has to be some kind of explanation for—
I'm done talking, he growled. I'm not standing around here with these stupid bones. Got that?
David trudged ahead to meet him.
Bro, you're going to hurt yourself. Seriously. Eli's right. We should—
Then I guess I'll meet you two at the top,
he snapped, barreling on as quickly as his injured ankle would allow. The two of us let Tom build some distance. We trekked slowly behind him, certain that he had brought along the mess of bones, which we took for realistic Halloween props, as a prank. As I reflect on the incident all these years later, I no longer think they were fakes. The snowfall started up again within an hour. I admit, my stomach dropped at the sight of the initial flurries. The sky quickly darkened and the mountain began dumping fresh fistfuls of the stuff upon us as we struggled to make the least dent in our itinerary. However stubborn, Tom wound up with no choice but to lay off the gas. He refused to stop hiking altogether, but surrendered the lead position to David when the snow began to fall. He slowly fell into the rear, and the two of us had to turn and check up on him frequently for fear that he might get left behind. Before the end of the fourth day, we all knew in our guts that the trip was effectively over. Far from completing our climb in an audacious 10 days, we were going to have no choice but to throw in the towel and head back to the base if we wanted to return home before our vacations were up. We crawled on bitterly, the snow gaining force and our spirits dipping with every trudging step. David stomped at the head of the pack, kicking himself for having invited Tom in the first place, while I kept to the middle position. There, my scarf and goggles on tight, I tried to keep a close eye on Tom. The sharp whistle of the wind as it cut across the white wasteland left my ears ringing. Visibility was dropping sharply. It wasn't quite a whiteout, but the constant fogging of my lenses rendered me half blind as I tried to stagger on. With my senses dulled by the weather, it's perhaps no surprise that I began to doubt them. At one junction, I turned to check up on Tom and was alarmed to find he had fallen quite far behind. His snail-like pace had left him a blurry fleck in my field of vision. He wavered with his head low and frequently struggled to remain upright. I stopped to give him a chance to catch up and palmed the snow from my goggles, only then realizing that his haphazard advance reeked of panic. The guy was stumbling, crawling, writhing through the snow as if his life depended on it. And the wind brought his blubbering cries to my ears.
Guys! Guys, wait up! Please!
Even from afar, the tremor in Tom's voice was noticeable. He wasn't just asking us to slow down. He was begging, on the verge of tears. Making sure that David wasn't getting too far ahead, I momentarily backtracked to let Tom catch up. That was when I saw it. I blinked hard through my goggles, not sure that I could trust my eyes. Tom's shambling silhouette against the wall of perfect white entered into focus, as did something else, which seemed only a stone's throw from his heels. I'll never be able to perfectly describe what it was. There was too much snow, too much wind, too much distance. I am certain, though, that something, frankly someone, was following Tom. A dark silhouette loomed behind him, at times coming so close that the two overlapped in my sight. Clothed not in a brightly colored coat, but in a dark and billowing garb, I watched this individual shadow Tom with a surge of horror in my breast.
Tom!
I shouted.
Tom!
I bolted towards him, arms raised in warning. And I suppose it was that racket I made that doomed us all. The ground beneath my feet felt suddenly hollow. I lost my balance and fell to my knees. The roar of wind quickly supplanted by odd drum-like sounds, the likes of which I had never heard. It was the sound of a releasing slab. In an instant, tons of snow and ice came barreling down the slopes. I was thrown like a rag doll onto my side and watched as the whole mountain seemed to leap up into the air. An avalanche.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Trapped beneath the snow, scarcely able to move, I did my best to create a little air pocket with my chin. Sucking in a few breaths, I shouted for all I was worth in the newfound stillness. Cold, blood-chilling cold, attacked me from every side. I felt ice creep into my boots, sensed it on my face and hands. Thrown violently down the slope and pummeled by the speeding slab, I was thoroughly disheveled. My pack had been torn from my shoulders and my jacket had burst open, inviting in the frost it had been worn to shun. I could have died there. It would have been easy to give in to that cold. Had David not heard my muffled cries and dug me out with his ice axe, I'm sure that I would have perished. Thankfully, he had been hiking far ahead of Tom and I, and had narrowly avoided the fallen snow. As soon as conditions had stabilized, he had gone searching for us. I emerged 10 or 15 minutes after the disaster, thoroughly dizzied, and was reacquainted with the howling storm.
Eli, where's Tom? Do you know where he was before the avalanche? Where was he situated? We have to find him. There isn't much time.
David thrust a trekking pole into my hand.
Come on, we gotta find him.
Dazed though I was, the situation proved emergent enough to rally my battered limbs, and I joined David in canvassing the slope. I dug into the snow and went looking for traces of Tom, his clothing, his pack, anything. 30 minutes, then 60 passed, bringing no sign of him. A second grueling hour ticked by without success. That was when panic began to set in.
He could suffocate,
uttered David, hunched so as to shield himself from the punishing wind.
We're running out of time. He's got to be here somewhere. Dig, man, dig!
I will spare you the monotonous details, the frightened tears we shed as we turned the mountain inside out in search of Tom. The desperate swings of the ice axe that turned up nothing of use. It was almost 3 hours after the avalanche, when David and I were both shuddering and on the verge of collapse, that we dug up Tom. He had been carried away by the slab and buried deep, and on the way down it appeared as though he had been dashed against certain outcroppings. Jellied blood clung to his wounds and his face, when drawn up out of the white, was almost powder blue. If he was still breathing, then neither of us could tell. David and I hauled him out of the frost and carried him to the stablest bit of ground we could find. There we fumbled with David's tent, and the three of us took shelter inside, taking stock of our collective injuries. I knew I was going to lose at least one of my fingers. I'd shed one of my gloves in the fall, and my exposed hand was pounding as though I'd touched it in an open flame. My fingertips were dusky, and to my horror, I could scarcely bend them. David had come away with a wind-burned face, but was otherwise in good health. We had only to take a look at Tom under the light of the headlamp to know that he was in a very, very bad way, however. He was as cold as ice from head to toe, and hadn't stirred once. It was possible that he was still alive, but suffering from severe hypothermia. It was possible, too, that he was dead. We tried to find the pulse in his rigid limbs and held a bit of a mirror to his lips, but could see no evidence of breath. David and I both did what we could to warm him. We wrapped him in our warmest clothes, nestled up beside him, and tried using a camping stove to generate more warmth in the tent. None of it seemed to make any difference, though. Outside, the wind was growing truly monstrous. The tent was pulled this way and that by rogue gusts. David, a steadier presence in the face of emergencies than I, peered outside and made a grave prediction.
"If this storm gets any worse, we're done for," he said. "With all this wind and heavy snowfall, there could be another avalanche. It's only a matter of time. We can't stay here. This tent won't hold up. We're too exposed."
"Where can we possibly go?"
I asked. I'd been desperately trying to reawaken my frozen digits, bathing them in lukewarm water to little effect. The pain was enormous.
"Should we move the tent?"
"No," said David. "If there is another avalanche, the tent will be torn to shreds. We have to move. Get out of here."
"There's no way we can descend fast enough. Not with Tom like this."
David sighed and fell deep into thought. When he finally surfaced, it was with another brief glance at the storm outside.
"We need to find one of those emergency shelter buildings."
Mountainous destinations the world round are in the habit of offering climbers sturdy shelters to use in the event of emergencies. These structures, often built to withstand the elements and sometimes stocked with food and other supplies, can be the difference between life and death in unstable environments. Unfortunately, despite the hostile climate, the Himalayas are home to very few of these shelters.
"I don't think there are any of those around here," I lamented. "There are only a few scattered around the whole Himalayan range. We could walk for days and never find one. We could walk for days and never find one."
"No,"
continued David.
"I remember reading about it before we set out. There's one simple shelter here on Mara Peak, maybe 6,000 or 7,000 feet up."
He dug around in his pockets for the altimeter and studied it.
"I mean, I can't guarantee we'll find it in these conditions, but we're not that far off."
"It's reckless," I said.
"If we set out in this..." "Yeah, I know. But if we stay, we're goners,"
he interjected.
"Our only real shot is finding the shelter. If this reading is accurate, we're only a few hundred feet off. We can make it. Even with Tom in tow."
I glanced at poor Tom, still searching for signs of life in him.
"So, we carry him then?"
David nodded.
"Strap on whatever you can for warmth. Protect those fingers. We'll haul him along with us. We'll be a lot warmer in a shelter with solid walls than we are in here. We can wrap him in the tent to keep the snow off of him."
He stood.
"We've got to get moving, though, before the storm gets any worse."
I had no fight left in me and surrendered.
"All right, man. Lead the way."
We double-checked our gear and wrapped ourselves as tightly as we could. The tent was broken down and Tom was wrapped snugly in the canvas. Together we shared the burden and went trudging through the snow, groaning and staggering, cursing and shivering. The two of us had to stop frequently at first to get our bearings. But after a solid march of an hour and change, we managed to reach a broad table in the mountainside, where a small roof structure was visible in the distance. Built directly against the mountain, the windowless thing was made of stone and fronted by a thick metal door. On the whole, it looked about as spacious as a dorm room or walk-in closet, and the tilted roof was already buried in drifting snow. We raced toward it and worked together to yank open the stubborn door. The latch and hinges had been frozen, and we only managed to get in by hacking away the ice with our tools. Throwing open the door, we dragged Tom inside and shut ourselves in. The interior was black as pitch, though we soon discovered a few battery-operated lamps within. There were two beds inside and a few chairs, a wood-burning stove, a small stack of firewood, a wooden cabinet filled with canned goods and preserved foods, a few rugs and blankets, and some basic climbing supplies had also been left in case of emergencies on the mountain. We immediately set Tom on one of the beds and started the fire, praying all the while that we could revive him. Water was warmed and we took stock of our remaining supplies. For a time, we grew hopeful. Against all odds, we had found a little shelter and were now safe against the elements. David and I took turns looking after Tom, and I spent some time nursing my own wounds as well. "As soon as the weather improves," said David, daring optimism, "we can get out of here. From this spot, it's a straight shot down to the base, more or less. We can use some of the supplies in here to climb down faster when the time comes. If Tom is feeling better, he can join us. Or if he can't tag along, we'll go down, find help, and come back for him. We made it, dude. We're gonna be okay." I allowed myself to share in his optimism. As the fire crackled in the little stove, the two of us sat before it and soaked up the warmth. "Just have to wait for the weather to improve," I echoed, looking to Tom. "We're gonna get you out of here, man. Hang in there." In all actuality, Tom had probably died within minutes of the avalanche. Critically injured by the fall and effectively smothered by the snow, there was nothing we could have done to save him. We tried every trick we knew, of course, but within hours of arriving at the shelter, it was clear that he was gone. Attempts to pick up a pulse, trace a breath, resulted in nothing. Thawing his limbs with gentle baths of warm water did no good. There was a lot of guilt, of course. David felt terrible for having insisted on his coming along, and I felt mighty bad myself. Not only because I'd co-signed the decision, but because I'd foolishly triggered the avalanche that had gotten us into this mess. We took one of the blankets from the other bed and draped it over him as a shroud, agreeing that once we descended, we'd find help and come back for his body. And so there we were, the two of us stuffed into this tiny nook with a half-frozen corpse, waiting for the snow to stop falling. There was just one problem. It wasn't going to stop, not anytime soon. 3.5 days of wild wind and heavy snowfall left us wondering if we'd ever have a chance to make our planned journey down the mountain. The firelight was our chief source of illumination in the little hovel, which made us feel almost like Neanderthals sitting around in a dim cave. Whenever necessary, we'd break out our flashlights and lamps for brief bursts of added light, but we tried to keep this to a minimum in the interest of preserving battery power. We ate some of the stockpiled food, warming tin cans over the stove, and I kept a close eye on my frostbitten hand. My pinky finger was already turning black by that point, immovably stiff. We woke up one morning to what seemed like perfect quiet. For days and nights, the wind had pounded upon the little shelter, but now we awoke on our shared bed to eerie silence.
"The snow,"
I think it's finally stopped, ventured David. Could be.
I stood up and stretched. Placing a hand against the metal door, I could feel the cold radiating through it.
Throw another log on the fire real quick. Let's see what we're working with here, yeah?
Sure, replied David, rummaging through the stack of firewood.
Maybe if things are calm enough, we can head down this afternoon.
I opened the door to take a look at the aftermath. Or at least I tried to. The thing wouldn't budge.
It's stuck. Give me a hand, will you?
David rose and joined me by the door. Together we pressed on the handle and gave it a hard shove, and then another. Chuckling to ourselves, we tried it a third time. There was considerably less chuckling during the fourth and fifth attempts. Our next dozen trials were staged in fraught silence.
Oh no!
David pawed at the smooth metal, pushed and nudged it from every angle to no effect. In a darkly humorous turn, the door to our little shelter could only open outward. Though we applied a great deal of pressure from the inside, literally charged against it with our bodies to the point of injury and hysteria, we couldn't get it to move an inch. Many hundreds of pounds of drifting frozen snow had settled against the other side, effectively trapping us within. We had no way of knowing just how much snow we were dealing with, or when a thaw might begin. All we knew was that the door would not open, and that the two of us were now imprisoned in the shelter with the corpse of our late friend. David raged against the door so long he worked his shoulder into a pulp. Panting, he slumped to the floor and buried his head in his hands.
The snow will melt. It has to.
He trembled, leveling his teary gaze upon the door, our betrayer.
We'll try again later in the day. Or maybe tomorrow. We'll be out of here soon.
In fact, we would go on to remain in the shelter for weeks. Time became a blur. The numbers on our watches came to mean nothing. Deprived of sunlight and the open air, we could only cower in the glow of the fire and imagine the scene outside the shelter. There was water enough for the two of us stored up in the little edifice, though we drank it down to nearly the last drop by the time all was said and done. Odd drafts crept into the structure now and then, reminding us of the outdoors and providing tantalizing clues as to the conditions without. Winds came and went. Heaps of snow were surely displaced, but for all these changes, we could not force the door open. The trying of the door became a daily ritual. After meals, when we had given ourselves some time to digest, we would batter the thing until utterly ruined by fatigue. Each time we would retire bitterly, but cling to a vain hope that tomorrow things would be different.
If only Tom could help,
said David after one of our many unsuccessful attempts.
He was tough. He would have knocked this door off its hinges, I bet.
It's strange and a bit unsettling in retrospect the way Tom became a mere object sharing our space. Though we spoke of him from time to time and took care to treat his body with some respect, the corpse on the bed began to fade into the background. He had been left in the bed furthest from the stove and had been little disturbed since our arrival. Our daily business was conducted over and around him. He was, in some sense, just another piece of furniture in the room. When the lad began to decompose, however, it became more difficult to ignore him. The inside of the shelter had attained a tolerable level of warmth thanks to the constant burning of the stove. When we ran out of firewood, David and I began breaking down furniture in the shelter, feeding bits of chairs, shelves, and even rugs into the cast iron unit to keep the warmth flowing. This heat was a boon for us living occupants, but kick-started processes in our deceased friend, which in time made the shelter nigh unlivable. We had not foreseen the fact that the increased warmth would urge Tom's body to rot. What began as faint odor, a weird smell in Tom's corner of the room, soon became a revolting musk. Tissues breached by decay would loose rank scents with suddenness. The bed he occupied grew slick with the seepage of failing flesh, and from his depths there rose such noxious fumes as are ordinarily and mercifully confined to the grave. Our air was gradually tainted so that before long, our every breath contained something of Tom in it. One night, while David slept upon the other bed and I paced the floors in restlessness, I happened to glance at Tom. The fire was low, in need of another chair leg, and all was bathed in syrupy black. Standing at the foot of Tom's bed, and overcome by the fumes that poured out of him, I discovered that his body had lately shifted somewhat, that on account of deterioration, his corpse had changed position. As a result, the makeshift pall we tossed over him, stained with fragrant juices, no longer covered his face. I regarded Tom's dead countenance half in horror and half in curiosity as I stood there in the low light. His eyes were open, all color chased out of them by a white, milky film. His features, once even and handsome, were marred by patches of necrotic black. Frostbitten tissues were being eaten away with alarming swiftness. His blackened nose, cheeks, and ears had broken down into festering rubble. The effect was horrifying indeed. But still, I beheld the sight with a certain curiosity. I wonder now if my inhalation of Tom's volatile gases hadn't altered my mind, or if it was simply the way the firelight fell upon his cratered face. Yes, the surface level of Tom's visage was breaking away in dramatic and revolting fashion, but I couldn't get away from the impression that just beneath it, a new face, new features were in some way debuting. The tongues of flame in the stove were reflected in his dead eyes, and I saw, or believed I saw, them shift subtly in his gooey sockets. I imagined his frostbitten hands reaching up and clawing at the remainder of his old face. My imagination burned with visions of a new body, a new man rising from the decaying wreckage of Tom's corpse. I was used to strange thoughts by this time, of course, and said nothing of my impressions to David. I simply picked up the soiled shroud and spread it over Tom before stationing myself at the fire. A few nights before we finally broke out of the shelter, I was awakened by David. I presumed it happened in the middle of the night, though I didn't check my watch and verify the time. At any rate, I regard that whole imprisonment in the shelter as one long, continuous night. I'd been sleeping uneasily in the bed for a while, when subject to a few violent shakes, I was drawn suddenly to wakefulness and alarm.
What's going on?
I asked, almost tumbling to the floor. David, though, pressed a clammy hand to my mouth. He gripped my shoulder and then made several gestures, impressing upon me the need for quiet. Bewildered, I nodded, remaining silent as instructed. Sure that I wasn't about to open my mouth again, David removed his hand and shakily pointed across the room, in the direction of the other bed. Tom's bed. I turned my bleary eyes toward the corpse. It remained there, draped by the blanket, just as we had left it. I sat up a little, offered a weak shrug. I couldn't tell what he was driving at, what possessed him to wake me in such a fashion. David stood between the bed and the stove, gaze never wavering from Tom's still form. Several moments passed without explanation. Finally, he tugged at me, drawing me close. Leaning in, he whispered,
Did you hear that, Eli?
I hesitated. From where I sat, only David's labored breathing and the pop of the fire in the stove were audible. There wasn't even any wind then, at least none that I could discern. I shook my head.
Did I hear what?
Shuddering violently, David's gaze remained fixed on the corpse.
Just a little bit ago, while I was sitting by the fire,
he whispered.
He started laughing.
I started, an incredulous grin taking root upon my lips.
I'm sorry. What? You heard Tom? Laughing? I'm not lying,
insisted David, clutching at the headboard.
I mean it. I heard him laughing, and...
He licked his lips, chest heaving.
It didn't sound like Tom.
How do you mean?
It wasn't Tom's laugh. It wasn't his voice.
David sucked in a deep breath, steadying himself.
It's someone else under that sheet.
To be frank, I was skeptical. Though I myself had been entertaining odd notions during our imprisonment, the idea of a chuckling corpse was a bridge too far, even for me. I stood up, shaking off David's hand, and shuffled toward Tom. Carefully, I flicked on a small battery-powered lamp and turned down the shroud, studying the spoiled slumberer beneath. Tom's corpse did not move. His blackened lips could not have been said to curl in anything like a smile, and the gel that oozed from his gaping sockets was not to be mistaken for tears of mirth. The man was good and dead. Whatever David had heard, I felt sure that it hadn't come from Tom. And yet this brief survey did nothing to combat my earlier impressions. Studied up close, I couldn't help sensing a deep change in the corpse. Everything on the surface, everything we had once called Tom, was in the process of being destroyed. Beyond this deteriorating mask, however, something else, something unfamiliar, seemed to be emerging. I held my tongue about this. To this day, in fact, I have never been honest with David about my impressions of Tom in those final days. Nevertheless, considering what came afterward, he has reason enough to suspect what I withheld. The day we broke free of the shelter, we awoke in profound desperation. We had burned just about everything in the hovel that could answer for firewood, and had run through nearly all the water and food despite careful rationing. We arose that day determined to force open the door, or to die trying. Speaking only for myself, I will tell you that I had never made such an intense and brutal effort in all my life as I did that day against the door. I threw myself into it bodily, trained myself against the latch like a battering ram, and worked in concert with David to knock it open. Our first sign of success, wherein we managed to ease the door open just a few inches, invigorated us. We built on this initial progress by striking the door until its rough metal edges began carving into the wall of snow and ice on its other side. Bloodied and achy, we eventually opened it far enough to exit. In the end, I do not believe it was our strength or tenacity that allowed us to force the door. Rather, after days of middling temperatures and changes in the wind, the drifts that kept us prisoner for weeks had finally grown small enough to be overcome. The weather outside was unspeakably pleasant. Compared to the four walls we had been staring at for weeks, the sight of the gloomy, windswept mountain was enough to bring tears to our eyes. We hastily packed our things and geared up, preparing to make a precipitous climb down the nearest ledge. We were less than half an hour in preparing, and we set out through the dense snow with a spring in our step. Our descent was swift. In fact, it was reckless. When we made it to the bottom, I realized that I'd lost my frostbitten pinky somewhere along the way, thanks to a little thing they call auto-amputation. In my haste, I hadn't even noticed. We made it back down to the base of Mara Peak a few hours after sundown, and succeeded in making our way onto the winding road which rings it. There we had to wander for close to 2 hours before we spied a passing vehicle. Convincing the motorist to stop and help us, we were ferried to the nearest town, where the two of us received basic medical care and were put in touch with local authorities, informing them that Tom was still up on the mountain in the emergency shelter. A recovery operation was planned for the next afternoon. A helicopter was used for the purpose, and a number of skilled volunteers descended upon the snowbound shelter to retrieve our friend's corpse. What happened in that shelter between our descent of the peak and the arrival of the rescuers the next day is the subject of much conjecture. David and I both have our theories, of course. And it is on account of those theories that neither of us will ever again set foot in the Himalayas. The rescuers entered an empty shelter plagued by the smell of death. Puzzlingly, though, their thorough search turned up no sign of the sought-after body. The bed in the corner was found to be empty. The dead man we had left in it was simply gone. Upon finding no corpse in the shelter, the authorities naturally tried to cobble together an explanation. Bits of gangrenous and degraded tissue were found scattered about the room. In light of this, it was supposed that a wild animal had fed on Tom, torn at his body, and subsequently dragged him off into the frozen wilds. A sound enough theory, all things considered. Just what predator could possibly have a taste for nauseous fare as this, they could not say, however. Furthermore, there were no visible tracks around the shelter that could identify the alleged beast. The drifting snow had likely obscured them. If there is one wrinkle in the narrative spun by these authorities, it is the alleged presence of several items, all of them retrieved from the site and shown to both David and I for verification purposes, belonging to Tom, which were found outside the shelter. The pair of boots, the jacket, and other articles of clothing that were brought to us were the ones Tom had died in. Of that, neither of us had the least doubt when questioned. We had left these items on his body for all those weeks, having no use for his stench-ridden gear. It is claimed that they were tucked neatly, left folded, beside a small conical mound of sticks and stones, which was itself taken for a rustic memorial. Neither David nor I had bothered constructing such a memorial, but we didn't bother telling the authorities that we had seen its like before. And come to think of it, I have never heard of a species of predator, whether bear or wolf, that carefully undresses its festering prey and leaves its boots shined and clothing pressed before dragging it off. Nonetheless, when the incident at Mara Peak comes up in conversation, I tend to agree with this down-to-earth explanation. You see, from where I'm standing, it's close enough to the truth. Something did make off with Tom. It followed us up the mountain. It shadowed him as he limped along. It infiltrated his body. And when death stole over him, it germinated within its frostbitten husk, repurposing what it could so as to live again. In solitude, when David and I had gone, the thing had finally surged to life. shaking off and tearing away the old dead tissues it had gone staggering out of the shelter. And had the snow but ceased its drifting, the authorities would have surely discovered a set of perplexing prints leading out of the building. Not mine, not David's, not the prints of some hungry beast. They would have been the prints of a man, of a thing that had once been a man, leading not to the base of Merritt Peak, but higher up, I imagine, into its remote interior. And that was The Incident at Merritt Peak by Ambrose Ibsen. A good reminder to leave that third wheel at home. Nothing but trouble, those guys. This story is from Ambrose Ibsen's book From the Heart, 13 Tales of Terror. It's available now on audible.com, and the one and only Jeff Sturdivant would really appreciate you picking up a copy. Ambrose Ibsen is the author of nearly 50 novels and short story collections, most notable From the Heart, which Jeff got to narrate, and that's why it's most notable, because Jeff got to narrate it, and he writes these scripts, so I really don't have a choice, do I? Therefore, he gets to declare what's most notable. So please make this book actually notable and pick up a copy from audible.com or a Kindle or print copy from Velox Books, your source for premium unleaded nightmare fuel. And be sure to tune in tomorrow to The Crimson Hour with Drew Blood, because if you like this one, we've got another one on the way. Hey, thanks, Ambrose. It was a real pleasure.
And do old Drew Blood a favor, would you? Subscribe to his podcast wherever you do your listening and leave him a 5-star review and a kind word, even if you're listening on YouTube. He needs soldiers on all fronts to win this battle, and he appreciates it. To hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all the other episodes, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click Patrons in the upper menu. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to their entire audio archive, all ad-free and available to download or stream. Thank you for your time and for supporting our sponsors. When you support our sponsors, you support this show. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all the latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with them each and every week. Oh, and you can find Drew Blood on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. The Drew Blood's Dark Tales podcast is accepting submissions, friend. If you've got a story or two you'd like to be featured on the show, send it to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, you'll get the full treatment, 10 bananas.
Well, I guess this is where we part ways, at least till tomorrow. Come visit me on The Crimson Hour every Saturday night at 7 Central on YouTube and all your favorite podcast platforms. We've got another one from tonight's author, and I know you'll love it. So may the wind be at your back, and may the road rise up to meet you. Hit that like button on your way out, would you? And until next time, y'all, go fuck yourselves. I know I will. Good night, y'all.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. Kalshi. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.